From the Moon Broadcasting Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Frank Stoltz. Governor Brown ordered new DNA testing on four pieces of evidence in the case of Kevin Cooper, who was convicted of murdering a couple, their 10-year-old daughter, and an 11-year-old boy in Chino Hills in 1983. We'll talk about what it means for the case right after the news. Good morning. You're listening to Air Talk. It's December 26th, the day after Christmas. I hope everyone had a wonderful holiday yesterday. I'm Frank Stoltz, in for Larry Mantle, who is on a well-deserved holiday vacation. The partial government shutdown has entered into its fifth day with no signs of relenting. The impasse is over the $5 billion President Trump wants for the border wall. The Democrats have said no to that amount. Since Friday, some 800,000 federal employees have been affected by the partial shutdown, which accounts for about 25% of government agencies. The Senate reconvenes tomorrow, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the Senate would only bring a vote on a funding measure to the floor if there's a commitment from President Trump that he'd sign it. Stay tuned for updates throughout the day on kpcc.org. There's been a new development in one of the most closely watched cases involving a California death row inmate. On Christmas Eve, Governor Brown ordered new DNA testing on four pieces of evidence in the case of Kevin Cooper, who was convicted of murdering a couple, their 10-year-old daughter, and 11-year-old boy in Chino Hills in 1983. Brown wants more precise DNA tests on four items, including a bloody T-shirt and hatchet. Cooper has long said he's innocent, and his lawyers have said that the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department framed him. Prosecutors in San Bernardino are steadfast in arguing he should be put to death. He committed the murders. For a closer look at this case, we turn first to Don Thompson, reporter at the Associated Press, who's been following it. Don, thanks for joining us. Perhaps begin by giving us a background on this case for those who don't know the name Kevin Cooper.
Yeah, well, as you said, it's all murders are brutal. This one was a knife and axe slaying of a couple, their two young children, an 8-year-old boy was the only survivor. He was grievously wounded, and law enforcement centered fairly quickly on Mr. Cooper, who had probably wishes he had not escaped or walked away from a minimum security prison nearby just 2 days before those slayings. They say that DNA evidence supports his conviction. He's exhausted his appeals. He's awaiting execution if California does begin them again. His attorneys say that some of that evidence was planted. Some of the things were found like days after the fact, where they were not found in an initial search, for instance, of a nearby hiding place where he was found. That some of the stuff was planted and that the new, more sophisticated DNA can show who really were the real killers.
I want to get to the more sophisticated DNA in just a moment. But first, it's kind of extraordinary because here's Kevin Cooper. He escapes from Chino Hills State Prison, where he's doing time for burglary. And he lands in the house next door to the one where these murders take place. And he became the primary focus of investigators. He says he just happened to be in that house.
Correct. Yeah, he says, well, he's claiming factual innocence, that he was not the guy that they centered on him once they found that he was nearby, and that the real killers, based on other evidence, may have been white men as opposed, or white or Hispanic men as opposed to Mr. Cooper, and that there's evidence that would show that, including some comments from the boy who survived.
This case does have a racial element. This is 1983. This is Chino Hills. The attorneys for Kevin Cooper say that investigators were too quick to grab onto an African American man and say that he was the murderer, and failed to follow leads that these three white men who were seen in a car and seen in a bar with blood on their clothes failed to follow that lead.
That's exactly right. So that's what this is. The governor's attempt to try to settle this once and for all. So he is ordering the testing of these four items, and in his view, unless it shows that somebody else's DNA was on it that can be, you know, pinpointed through searches of DNA searches that can center on them and, you know, rules out lab technicians, you know, deputies, evidence technicians who've handled it over the years, that that ought to put this case to rest. But the attorneys for Mr. Height and others say that this should show that there were others that were involved in this and show that there were his evidence was his DNA was planted on the items.
There is some evidence that the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department was engaged in some level of misconduct because, as I understand it, one of the pieces of clothing where the victim's blood was on it and Kevin Cooper's blood was on it, a chemical preservative was also found mixed with Cooper's blood, which suggests that the detectives or someone from the department had taken some of Cooper's blood, which was preserved, and then put it onto the victim's clothing.
Well, yeah, and the DA down in San Bernardino says that they're, you know, that doesn't really show anything, that it may have been as it was handled legitimately over the years trying to test this stuff. So there's, as always, two sides saying this, but certainly the attorneys for Mr. Cooper contend that that's, you know, sort of a telltale sign that this was mishandled over the years.
By the way, we reached out to Governor Brown's office for legal affairs, Secretary Peter Krause. They declined our request for an interview. Also reached out to San Bernardino County District Attorney Michael Ramos, who did not get back to us in time for today's show. This case has picked up significant steam over the years. Talk a bit about that, Don, in terms of folks from the legal community, some from the Hollywood community coming to the aid of Kevin Cooper.
Yeah, there's been a number of celebrities, I guess, that have been sort of taking up the cause here. So, and it sort of got some. They'd filed for this earlier this year, and then it took on, I guess, more steam when New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof wrote a column, and he's sort of taken it up as a one of his causes. You've had a number of others from Hollywood, and also U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, who was the AG, the state attorney general earlier, John Chung, you know, state treasurer and had been a gubernatorial candidate. So it's got some fairly high profile people behind it at this point.
Place this case in the context of California's death row. There are 740 condemned men, but the debate continues over whether how to execute or whether to execute, continue executing at all.
Yeah, and that's still going. Voters approved a measure a couple of years ago that intends to try to speed up executions, to speed up some of the appeals, to get around some of the procedural, the regulatory acts that would normally be in place for setting up the nuts and bolts of how you execute someone. So that's proceeding at this point. There are various court challenges. The Department of Corrections has what, you know, their regulations, their procedures in place at this point. Despite all the court challenges, also questions about whether they can even obtain the lethal drugs legally that would be used to execute someone. So that's been a problem in other states, or a hurdle in other states, and almost certainly would be here in California as well, even if the other portions of the death row protocol are in place.
Quick question. Any idea how long this extra testing that's been ordered by the governor will take? I mean, is this a matter of weeks or months or years?
Yeah, I don't think years. It seems like it might be at least weeks, if not months. They've got a lab that's suggested, although the governor is leaving that up to the special master, retired judge, who's going to be sort of acting as the administrator of this whole thing. And depending on which one he chooses and how they get down to some of the questions and answers between the defense and the prosecution, could be a bit before it's submitted. They have to get the material back out of evidence and all that sort of thing. So there's some steps before they even test it, and then it's the testing itself.
Thanks, Don, for joining us. That's Don Thompson, reporter at the Associated Press, who's been following the case. Thank you again, Don. We're talking about the case of Kevin Cooper. He is on death row, and he is was convicted of killing four people in Chino Hills in 1983. An African-American man whose lawyers say that he was targeted because he is black, and that a key leads to the possibility that three white men committed this murder were never followed up on. Now I want to bring on Norman Heil, attorney representing Kevin Cooper. Mr. Heil, thanks for joining us on KPCC.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
What do you hope will come out of this new DNA testing?
Well, what we hope will be shown is that the person who was wearing a T-shirt with blood on it from one of the victims that was found near the crime scene has the DNA of one of the three white or Mexican men who the surviving victim identified as the assailants. We have been certain that if we were able to do the type of state-of-the-art DNA testing that is available now, that we would be able to show that Kevin Cooper was not the assailant. And one of the things that Don Thompson mentioned was that the murder weapons in this case were four different items, and how a single person, which the prosecution claims is Kevin Cooper, could have wielded four weapons is beyond anybody's possibility. But the testing that we've asked for with respect to the T-shirt and to a orange towel that came from the victim's home that was found near the T-shirt, we hope will show who the person is who was wearing the T-shirt and who may have touched this towel. That will show that Kevin Cooper was not involved.
And the result could just be that there is other DNA on the T-shirt, on the towel, but there may be no name attached to it if that person has not been arrested for a felony in California, which automatically puts you in the state database.
Yes, it's possible that the DNA profile that will be determined from testing the T-shirt and the towel will be of a third person. Obviously, our contention is that that will prove that Kevin Cooper was not involved in these murders. The prosecution has said that the reason that Kevin Cooper, they are certain, did this crime is because his DNA is on the T-shirt. That was only found on a blood spot, which we think was planted. But if he wasn't wearing the T-shirt, then somebody else for sure was involved in the murders. And the prosecution's theory has been that it was only Kevin Cooper. So if there's another person who is determined to have been present and have gotten one of the victim's blood on him, that would prove that their theory is completely wrong.
It's your contention that San Bernardino County Sheriff's detectives engaged in misconduct in several ways, besides the potential planting of the blood on this T-shirt. How else?
Well, we know it is not disputed that the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department destroyed a pair of bloody coveralls that were found the night of the murders and identified as belonging to the person who we suspect is one of the murderers. They destroyed those bloody coveralls before trial without testing them and before the defense had any knowledge of them. We also know that they destroyed, or at least have let go missing, a blue shirt that was found also near the crime scene that had blood on it. We also know that they planted cigarette butts in the Ryan station wagon that they collected from the home that Kevin Cooper had been hiding out in. And that the planting of those cigarette butts in the Ryan station wagon is proved by the fact that when deputies inspected the Ryan station wagon, when they found it, they did not find these cigarette butts. They were found a couple of days later, supposedly by the same deputy sheriffs from the sheriff's department who had collected cigarette butts from the house that Kevin Cooper had been hiding in. So we're sure that they were planted. We also know that they planted a hatchet sheath, which is one of the items that the governor has allowed us to test. When the first members of the sheriff's department went into the house where Kevin Cooper was hiding out, they did a complete inspection of the house and found nothing on the floor in the bedroom. And then a day or two later, when they went into the house, they alleged that they had found this hatchet sheath on the floor of the bedroom, which wasn't there when they first went through. So these are the types of things that were engaged in by the Sheriff's Department, which we think show that they framed Kevin Cooper.
We did reach out to Governor Brown's office for Legal Affairs Secretary Peter Krause. They declined our request to talk. Let's go to break after right now. We're talking about the Kevin Cooper case. Governor Brown ordered new testing to be done on the evidence from the 1983 quadruple murder. We'll be right back. This is Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Frank Stoltz, sitting in for Larry Mantle. We are talking about the Kevin Cooper case. Governor Brown ordered new testing to be done on evidence from the 1983 quadruple murder. This is an important case, one of the most closely watched cases involving a death row inmate on California's death row because of a lot of circumstances, not least of which the defense claims that the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department essentially framed him for this murder. We are with Norman Heil, who is representing Kevin Cooper in this case. Mr. Heil, you allege a lot of planting of evidence of misconduct by the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department. Really, I don't think I've ever heard a case where there were so many acts of misconduct to frame someone.
It is a horrible story. Obviously, the crimes were horrible crimes. And the Sheriff's Department needed to solve this crime as soon as possible because people were afraid to go out at night. And also, the sheriff was running for re-election. So the fact that a black man was accused and then they created evidence to fit the crime is probably not so surprising given the time that this happened.
This is 1983. An African-American man has escaped from prison. There's been a quadruple murder. You're essentially saying that for political purposes and also because of what I guess could be described as institutional racism and some just bad luck by Kevin Cooper, because he escaped at a certain time and landed in the house next to where the murders occurred. That's why Cooper is sitting on death row now.
That's correct. And the evidence just continues to pile up that shows that these crimes were committed by a number of people, and they were described by the sole surviving victim as white or Mexican men. And unfortunately, the Sheriff's Department needed to find somebody, and an African-American was a very easy target. The fact of the matter is that we've had a number of law enforcement people, including Tom Parker, who is a former FBI agent, retired at this point, who have looked at the way in which the case was investigated. And those people, including Tom Parker, have concluded that Kevin Cooper was framed and that it was tunnel vision that the Sheriff's Department engaged in going after Kevin Cooper instead of searching for the three white or Mexican men who were seen the night of the murders in a nearby roadhouse bar and who left that bar covered in blood. And it is next to that bar that the tan T-shirt that is now going to be part of this DNA testing was found. And also the blue shirt with blood on it was also found in a different direction near this bar. So we have identification of these three white men who were in the bar the night of the murders, covered in blood. And we have two garments that they clearly discarded that were found near the crime scene. And we have the bloody coveralls, which the sheriff's office had in custody but then destroyed, that came from another white man who is a convicted murderer. So there's an awful lot of evidence that points to the fact that Kevin Cooper was framed and that the real murderers have managed to be able to get away with this all this time.
I should note there have been well over 100 people on death rows across America who have been exonerated. And I should note that Kevin Cooper was within 4 hours of being executed. I believe it was in 2004, and a federal appeals court stepped in to stop the execution. So this is an extraordinary case.
It is. And I'm glad you mentioned that in addition to the over 160 people who have been exonerated over the last 25 years after being sentenced to death, there have been three murderers who were exonerated in California in the last year. That shows that we continue to, unfortunately, find people who have been convicted and have lost all their appeals who turn out to be innocent. And those three people are William Richards, Vicente Benavides, and Craig Coley, all of whom were in California prisons within the last year but were exonerated after 20-plus years of being held wrongfully in our prisons.
The stakes are high, and getting to the truth is difficult sometimes when prosecutors don't want to re-examine their practices of the past. Norman Heil, representing Kevin Cooper, thank you for joining us on KPCC.
You're welcome.
Richard Eichelbaum is forensic scientist specializing in DNA trace recovery and bloodstain pattern analysis. And a co-founder of Independent Forensic Services, a private laboratory that specializes in recovery of trace evidence and touch DNA testing based in Denver. Touch DNA testing may play a key role in the Kevin Cooper case now that the governor has ordered some of the evidence to be retested. Mr. Eichelbaum, thank you for joining us on KPCC.
Thank you for having me.
What is touch DNA?
Well, mainly touch DNA is left by persons when they touch an item. And very often in homicides, that is items which are touched by the hands of a perpetrator. And in order to get a good DNA profile, the more force is applied, the better the chances of obtaining a DNA profile from that.
So is this new testing? Is this new ground for DNA testing?
Well, the touch DNA testing exists for a very, very long time. In the Netherlands, we started with that in 1997. We introduced it more or less in the United States in Colorado in a miscarriage of justice in the Tim Masters case. That was in 2008. So for here, it's in the United States, it's pretty new.
When you say the key is the force that people touch determines whether or not their DNA will be left on the surface, that kind of is logical. How often does that happen, and how will that play a role in this case? Because this DNA was collected in 1983, long before DNA testing.
Yeah, that's true. So DNA on itself is very stable. So it will stay if preserved under the right conditions. And we worked on very old cases out of the 70s and 80s, then the DNA will still be there. Different from blood, saliva, and semen, the touch DNA is coming from the hands. These are dying cells, and the quality of DNA in those cells is much less than in blood, for instance. So that's why I said, well, if somebody is strangulating someone or using a knife and stab someone, putting a lot of force on the knife handle, then he will leave enough DNA on the handle of the knife in order to obtain a DNA profile from.
Please, go ahead.
He will stay there also after 30 years, 40 years.
Yeah. So give us a sense of where touch DNA testing stands in terms of is there sort of this is an area that I don't know a whole lot about. Is there sort of a regular DNA testing that occurs, and this will be a higher level or a more precise test?
No, there are some new DNA kits. DNA kits is what we use to get a DNA profile, and those are more sensitive. Furthermore, we have developed special techniques where we amplify the DNA a little bit more than usual so that we detect very small amounts of DNA. So that is improved. But we still use the same DNA techniques as with the standard DNA profiling.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is this. Take the bloody T-shirt, for example, which was found near the bar where the men were found or seen with bloody clothing, and those three white men also seen in the station wagon of the folks who were killed. What I'm trying to get at is this the first time that that particular T-shirt will be tested? I don't think so, because they've already done some testing and found Kevin Cooper's blood there, as well as the victim's.
Now, I don't know what they really tested in this case, but on common, you can say that if you want to know somebody was present during a violent crime, then you can look for DNA of the victims on the shirt of the perpetrator. And of course, if you just find a shirt somewhere, we have those robberies very often on the road or in a bank, for instance, then you can look for the person who was wearing that shirt or the balaclava, for instance, at a certain time. And then you look with a shirt, for instance, you can look under the armpits or in the neck area. And that can be investigated. And that's different from looking for bloodstains.
Will familial DNA testing play a role here? I know that increasingly is being used by law enforcement.
So it's possible. If you get a good profile from an item, then, of course, the first thing law enforcement does is put it in the DNA database, CODIS, and then you can search for people who have been convicted earlier in a crime. If that doesn't happen, then you can look through familial searching in databases and see if you can find somebody who's related to this person of interest.
And what was extraordinary just recently in the Golden State Killer case was that they actually obtained a good lead from one of the genealogy websites that led them to the serial killer in California, the Golden State Killer. Do you know if that's now regular order at police departments where they also search genealogy websites?
Yeah, we get more and more questions about that. And police is certainly interested in that. And the first thing is, of course, do the DNA testing and find out whether or not you get a good profile. But only if you have a good profile, then you will be able to start doing the familial searching or the testing which was done during the Golden Gate killings.
Hmm. We've been talking about the Kevin Cooper case. Governor Brown has ordered new DNA testing in the Cooper case. Cooper sits on death row, convicted of killing four people in Chino Hills in 1983. The new DNA testing, his attorneys hope, will point to someone else as the killer. Richard Eichelboom, thank you for joining us on KPCC.
Thank you for having me.
Richard Eichelboom, forensic scientist specializing in DNA trace recovery and bloodstain pattern analysis. This is Air Talk. I'm Frank Stoltz, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Stay with us. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Frank Stoltz, sitting in for Larry Mantle. We're talking about criminal justice reform in just a moment. We just finished a conversation about a man on death row who may be innocent. I just want to point out that it's extraordinary some of the changes that have happened in law enforcement over the past 30 or 40 years in terms of watchdogging law enforcement, in terms of departments reforming themselves, in terms of the federal government sometimes coming in and mandating reforms. And that case that we just talked about was in 1983 when watchdogs were few still are few in certain areas like San Bernardino County. I'll point out it was just 3 years ago that L.A. Got its first civilian oversight commission of the sprawling L.A. Sheriff's Department. So we have to remind ourselves sometimes that folks who've been sitting in prison for a long time were prosecuted under a different criminal justice system. In a year full of political division, the federal criminal justice reform bill signed by President Trump last Friday was a rare bipartisan victory. The formerly incarcerated Reenter Society Transformed Safely Transitioning Every Person Act, Boy, that's a mouthful. Or First Step Act, easier, had support from various lawmakers and groups and was championed by Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner. It enacts prison and sentencing reforms, giving judges more leeway in sentencing, retroactively applying earlier sentencing reforms, and paving the road for earlier pre-release custody for certain inmates. However, the First Step Act only extends to the federal prison system, meaning that nearly 90% of inmates will not be affected. Most are convicted in state courts. So what will the actual impact of the bill be on California? Joining us to take a look at this is one of the state's leading criminologists, Franklin Zimmering, professor of law and faculty director of the Criminal Justice Research Program at UC Berkeley, and his most recent book, When Police Kill. Professor Zimmering, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Straight up, we've seen in California lots of reforms of the state criminal justice system. Now we see the federal system reforming to a certain extent. How will those new reforms affect California?
Well, I think I want to underscore that to a certain extent, the First Step Act in the federal system is good news, but it's very limited good news for California and for the other the 49 states. The federal system is small, it's atypical, and federal reforms aren't contagious to the states. The federal system actually is under 10% of all the people locked up. They're about 9% of the people in prison, and far smaller than that for the people in jails in the United States. It's atypical because a lot of the run-up in federal prisons was a function not of local prosecutors, but of legislative conduct and of the war on drugs, because the federal system is almost 60% drug prisoners and the seven dwarfs. And it is all a sort of discretionary, because the federal system only takes cases it wants to take.
This is a very important point. You mentioned, by the way, the seven dwarfs. Do you want to name them?
Well, the largest of the seven dwarfs that makes muscles, is so-called child pornography.
Okay.
Which has gone up 36-fold in terms of prison population in the last 25 years.
It was tiny to begin with.
It was tiny to begin with, but it's in the thousands now in the federal system.
So this has really driven the federal prison system and its population and the sentencing has been driven by the war on drugs.
Even though more people are in state prisons for drug crime than in federal prisons, the federal prison's share, if you talk about how federal prisoners get sentenced, is a much larger percentage of drug offenders.
What does this bill do in terms of reforming, relaxing, improving laws and sentences as they relate to drug offenses?
Well, the two, there are a lot of small things. The two big ones are, first of all, to make retroactive the release of prisoners who were at the wrong end of the crack cocaine to powdered cocaine difference in mandatory federal sentencing. For years, crack cocaine, which was inexpensive, less powder cocaine pure, but more associated with urban ghettos, had fabulously higher mandatory sentences for smaller amounts of cocaine than powdered cocaine. That was then changed, but the change hadn't become retroactive. And probably as many as 2,500 prisoners still in the federal system can be released once that retroactivity comes into play.
Many of these African-American men, many of them drug addicts, maybe small-time dealers.
Yeah, there is some difference of opinion about how many are dealers, because social sales and holding are called dealers by the people who prosecute them.
It's hard to overestimate the devastating impact of these laws on African-American urban communities around America, and these long prison sentences for these men. So
that's right. And they were not only long prison sentences, but they were very atypical in two respects. Number one, they were congressional mandatories. And number two, the Federal Sentencing Commission essentially created fixed prices of a particularly problematic sort, so that the judges had their hands tied. That then, which was atypical of the rest of the system, created a situation where Congress was the author of an awful lot of the overkill. State legislatures are not the major actors in the mass incarceration epidemic that the United States still suffers from at the state level.
District attorneys are.
Local prosecutors are. And the local prosecutor is in a very funny position still, and that is that local governments have all of the power in states like California to determine not only who goes to prison as opposed to probation, but how long they stay, but local governments pay none of the bills. The state government has 100% of the financial responsibility and practically none of the power.
Stay with us, Professor Zimring. We're going to bring in a couple of other guests here. What we're talking about is the Federal Criminal Justice Reform Act that was passed by Congress, signed by President Trump, and trying to dismantle, really, this criminal justice system, in many respects, unfair system that was created over the last four or five decades. We would love to hear from you. Call us at 866-893-5722. Perhaps you have a loved one who's locked up, or you've been locked up. You have a personal experience. That'd be great. Or if you just have a question, 866-893-5722 to weigh in on this issue. We're talking about the impact of this bipartisan criminal justice bill on California. Don Spector is executive director of the Prison Law Office, a nonprofit public interest law firm that provides legal services to prisoners based out of Berkeley, and really one of the driving forces of reform in California, and was a key player in the lawsuit that led to the federal order to shrink the prison population here. Mr. Spector, thanks for joining us. So what are your thoughts on this bill and how it will play out in California?
Well, I agree 100% with what Frank was saying. I think the biggest impact will not be so much in the numbers, because as Frank said, the number of federal prisoners is very small compared to the rest of the prison population. But what I do think is that it says it sends a really big signal to the rest of the country and to Republicans and to moderate Democrats that it's okay to reduce sentences. It's okay to provide recidivism-reducing programs, evidence-based recidivism-reducing programs to prisoners, and to reward those prisoners with time off their sentence if they complete the programs, and also to provide other incentives to prisoners, such as visiting more telephone calls, canteen, and the like, in order to get them to participate in these programs. And I think that California has been leading the way in many respects by not only the lawsuit that my office brought and litigated all the way up to the Supreme Court to reduce the prison population, but also by initiatives that reduced sentences, such as for people who were convicted of three strikes. And what I think that the First Step Act does, it's definitely a first step. It's not going to reduce mass incarceration in this country, but it could embolden the California legislature, which has been relatively passive in this respect, to really tackle mass incarceration in California and start reducing the sentences and rationalizing the sentences so as to reduce the prison population in both the prisons and the prisoner population in the jails as well.
We're talking about the impact of the bipartisan criminal justice bill on California. We'll continue with this conversation right after this short break. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC 89.3. We'll be right back. Taking a look at federal criminal justice reform, one of the few bipartisan efforts by Congress and President Trump over the last couple of years. We're joined now by Kate Chatfield, Policy Director for Restore Justice, a nonprofit that advocates for criminal justice reform in California. She's also an adjunct professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Thank you for joining us. Let me ask you, we know this doesn't affect near as many people as the criminal justice reforms in California did. Obviously, California is a huge system, the federal system, not as big. Nonetheless, I mean, this bill is significant because there are several thousands of people who were sentenced under pretty draconian laws.
Yes. Well, I mean, I would agree with that. I would, you know, just by way of numbers, I think the federal system has about 180,000 people currently incarcerated. To compare, California has about 130,000 people currently in prison and another 70,000 in county jails. So California has more prisoners and people in jail than the entire federal system, and California only has 10% of the nation's population. So Professor Zimmering is absolutely right that the change that needs to come at the state level if we are going to impact mass incarceration. In terms of what Mr. Spector said, I think I would disagree that the California legislature has been relatively passive in this regard. In fact, just this year, they passed felony murder reform. They allowed judges discretion to remove a 5-year prison prior. And they stopped the ability of prosecutors to charge 14 and 15-year-olds with adult crimes. So I actually think California is much further along in addressing mass incarceration than the federal system is. And, of course, you know, and I would agree with Mr. Spector that, I mean, it's a large extent of that is because of what we have done in recent years with Prop 47, mm-hmm. which reduced just simple drug possession to misdemeanor and reduce some shoplifting crimes to misdemeanors. And with Proposition 57, which is much, much more advanced than what the First Step Act does. So I'm not necessarily going to, you know, agree with the argument that this is going to be a way, that states or at least that California will follow the federal system in this regard.
Oh, yeah.
I think California is further along in this regard.
No doubt. Yeah, no doubt. The critics of these measures, both in California and the federal measure, say, hey, look, we're going to see an uptick in crime as a result of the relaxing of these sentences. And indeed, in California, there's some evidence that crime certainly has gone up, and there's been some evidence that it's connected to the sentencing reform. What do you think?
Oh, I think that is absolutely false. I think, first, there's not data that crime rates are tied to incarceration. There's just not that more prisoners, more prisons lead to reduced crime. And in fact, a big analysis that was done in 2004 by the Legislative Analyst's Office, and this is, you know, a nonpartisan, data-driven office of the state, and they looked at the Three Strikes Act 10 years into it. The Three Strikes Act was passed in 1994. They looked at crime rates in 2004. And yes, crime rates across the state and nationwide had fallen. They said, is this the result of more incarceration? And they and the conclusion was that it was not, because counties that had struck people out very frequently, the four counties, I think there was Kern County.
Is Zimring still with us?
Had used that, and their crime rates had dropped. San Francisco, which rarely used it, and Alameda County, their crime rates had dropped. So I do not accept the argument that there is a connection between crime rates and increased incarceration.
Frank Zimring, a criminologist at UC Berkeley, we've had various conversations over the years that reform may very well see an uptick in some crimes, but that what do you think about that in terms of this federal bill, and if it's a good trade-off?
Okay, it's impossible on the federal bill because, again, remember that those are drug crimes, and nobody phones in the police to report when they're taking drugs. We have no idea what goes on there. For California, you had the enormity of the realignment change, the largest single downward shift in incarceration anywhere in the country over the last 25 years. And you had a pretty good analysis of it by the Public Policy Institute of California, which is not a lobbying organization. And what they found was that there was a small uptick in one crime, auto theft, nonviolent, and that with regard to everything else, the largest downward shift that you could find to analyze was invisible in terms of affecting the rates of crime. There have been other discussions about, well, what about last year or last month? But this was the largest systematic study, and there are eight major index crimes. Seven out of eight, you could find no evidence of impact. There were somewhat more auto thefts.
Frank, I'm going to interrupt just real quick and ask you to give the 20-second answer to this question. I know that's almost impossible for a UC Berkeley professor, but please do. What is the number one reform that needs to happen to end mass incarceration?
Okay, very simple. Local governments have got to start paying the economic costs of imprisonment. When they do that, all of a sudden, their attention is focused on the economic consequences of their acts, and incarceration goes way down.
Excellent.
California did that starting in the mid-90s with its juvenile justice system.
And we should hear about that next time. Frank, you were fantastic. I appreciate your time. I want to thank all of our guests for this conversation. Stay tuned for more Air Talk in the next hour. I'm Frank Stoltz, in for Larry Mantle, and you're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. This is Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Frank Stoltz, sitting in for Larry Mantle, who's on vacation. This January 1st marks the one-year anniversary of California's legalization of recreational pot, and the state has come a long way in destigmatizing the drug. But that's not to say there isn't a long way to go before the marijuana industry settles all of its growing pains. Those attempting to get into the legal business claim the state's regulations are too stringent and the barrier for entry too costly. Additionally, weed is still a Schedule I drug under federal law. hampering potential for interstate commerce and growth, as well as blurring the lines of legality for past and present criminal possession charges. In the next hour of Air Talk, we will look at the reality of pot legalization in Los Angeles and around the state. We begin with Kat Packer. She is the executive director and general manager of the Department of Cannabis Regulation of Los Angeles, a department that didn't even exist a few years ago. Kat, thanks for joining us on KPCC.
Good morning, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing great. This month, California released its third and final draft of marijuana business regulations. What were some of the notable takeaways from that draft in terms of telling us how this industry has changed over the past year and where it's going?
Well, there have been a number of changes to the state's commercial cannabis regulatory framework. And, of course, cities, including the city of Los Angeles, has been closely tracking the state regulations and programs because under this new system, businesses, cannabis businesses that operate in the state of California need both a state license from one of the three state licensing agencies and a form of local authorization. We've been in close communication with our local regulators, with our local stakeholders, with local industry operators, with regulators from across the state of California and other folks to really track and manage what's happening. But we're hoping that with these final proposed regulations that were shared most recently, we will have a new sense of stability with how we move forward here in the city of Los Angeles.
Did I hear you say that businesses could get licenses, state licenses, from one of three state agencies?
Correct.
So there's no one agency they get the license from? You could go to any one of the three? What are the three?
So there is the lead agency for the state of California. It's a relatively new agency. It's the Bureau of Cannabis Control. It's housed within the Department of Consumer Affairs. And then the Department of Public Health and the Department of Food and Agriculture license and regulate commercial cannabis activity as well. So it depends on what type of commercial cannabis activity a particular operator is engaging in. For example, it's the Department of Public Health that licenses and regulates cannabis manufacturers in the state of California. But if you were going to open a testing license, or I'm sorry, a testing laboratory for cannabis, you would need to get a license from the Bureau of Cannabis Control.
How many businesses have been licensed in the past year, and how many are still awaiting licensing?
So I can't speak to the numbers outside of the city of Los Angeles, but I can note what's happening here in the city. And I do want to note that most cities and counties throughout the state of California actually still maintain commercial bans on cannabis activity. The city of Los Angeles developed a regulatory framework back in December of 2017, and our regulatory framework requires that we first move our businesses through what we call priority processing to get some form of authorization. So we have 169 retail locations that have authorization from the city of Los Angeles at this point, but there are a number of activities that we will be licensing in the city to include cannabis cultivation, manufacturing, testing, distribution, retail, and delivery. And so we are moving forward with our process and continuing to review applications in accordance with our local laws.
So you haven't licensed any delivery systems or growing operations?
So we have 169 businesses that have authorization from the city of Los Angeles at this point. Now, these businesses were a part of the city's previously existing medical market. These were businesses who had been compliant with Passity policies, and our ordinance allows us to give them authorization to engage in a number of activities. So these businesses can engage in cultivation, manufacturing, distribution, and retail sale, and delivery.
Okay, so when you say 169 authorized for retail, it includes delivery, cultivation, et cetera?
Correct.
Okay. How many are still awaiting licensing? I mean, do you have a pile of applications from people who are biting at the bit?
Absolutely. There's a lot of demand, particularly here in the city of Los Angeles, to open and operate a commercial cannabis business. And again, our ordinances require that the Department of Cannabis Regulation review and process those applications in a certain order. So at this point, we haven't been able to open up the application process largely for members of the general public. Our ordinance requires that we give priority processing to our existing medical market.
Which you've done, right, with the 169.
Correct. And then we have a second phase of licensing, which is for the existing supply chain to that market. And so we are moving along in this process, but it is a process.
We have a number of guests this hour looking at the legalization of marijuana in California 1 year later. And we, in fact, have a number of studio guests among them. Amanda Chicago Lewis, L.A.-based freelance reporter covering cannabis. She tweets from at MSA Amanda. Sorry, MS Amanda Lewis. I was getting too many letters in there. Thank you for coming into KPCC.
Great to be here.
What do you make of how the city has proceeded in terms of issuing licenses? How well has it gone? How poorly has it gone?
I mean, over the past decade, the city has utterly failed the public on this issue. You know, as Kat said, regulations came through in December of 2017, a full 10 years after they should have come through. This L.A. city controller has estimated in the past that there are 1,700 marijuana dispensaries within city limits. We're not even talking about the county there. As Kat said, there are 169 licensed storefronts. So that means that we're looking at about a 10-to-1 ratio of illegal storefronts to legal storefronts. And that's not a distinction that most Angelenos usually make. Usually you see a storefront, you assume cannabis is legal, and you say to yourself, oh, that's a legal business. And there's not a lot of legal risk for you to go in there and buy cannabis from that shop. And so very little happens there. And those businesses are not even able to apply for licensing yet. And so most of them are being raided and prosecuted by Los Angeles Police Department. A lot of that is ending up on these low-level employees, young bud tenders, young people of color who are being targeted in these raids. And
do you have any numbers on those?
Unfortunately, we don't have numbers around stuff like that. Okay. But, you know, if you also look, even if you look at the system of which dispensaries were given priority processing in the city of Los Angeles, that 169, it doesn't really make sense. It's not quite the fair policy that if people were paying more attention, they would think was a good idea.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's rolled out. I can remember city council meetings where neighborhood activists would show up and say, hey, we don't want a marijuana store in our neighborhood. They're smoking pot outside the school, et cetera, et cetera. We'd love to hear from you. Call us about this issue that we're talking about today, the legalization of marijuana in California 1 year later. The number is 866-893-5722 to weigh in on this issue. And it's 866-893-5722. We'd love to include you in this conversation. Amanda, the difference between a licensed and a non-licensed marijuana store is what? It's because there are certain regulations you have
Angeles
to have a security.
Specifically?
Yeah. Yes.
In Los Angeles specifically, and Kat could speak to this with probably more precision and detail, but it's my understanding that essentially you needed to be in operation by the end of 2007.
Well, I'm thinking actually more the regulations for a license versus a non-license.
In order to get a license in Los Angeles, you needed to have been in operation since 2007 and then survived federal raids, local raids, all those local NIMBY-oriented activists who wanted you out of there. Probably if you were a cannabis activist who was essentially breaking the law because none of those dispensaries were legal until this year, probably you were a white person because you survived raids and you survived, you know, a lot of financial hardship in order to stay open throughout long periods of illegality. So now you're licensed. Either you've been in operation since 2007 or you purchased the store from someone who was in operation since 2007. And you have good connections with the city to make that happen.
Kat Packer, very quickly, there are regulations for the licensed stores, I think, in terms of hours of operation, security, et cetera. Can you kind of give us a quick thumbnail?
Sure. These are built into the regulations themselves. Part of the difference between the licensed and unlicensed businesses is that the licensed businesses are expected to follow these rules and regulations that have been developed both by the state and the cities in which they operate. These require hours of operations, where specific cannabis businesses can be located.
Away from schools, away from parks.
Away from schools, parks, other sensitive uses that a locality may have chosen the state of California and our operators here have gone through a number of phases of testing requirements. So products that are being bought out of licensed facilities are expected to be tested for a number of different contaminants. Employees who work at these cannabis facilities are expected to be able to receive certain labor and workforce benefits, et cetera. And so there is a real difference that is starting to develop and emerge in the state of California and in the city of Los Angeles between who is licensed and who is not. And, of course, we want consumers to make responsible choices and to choose lawfully operating businesses both here in the city and throughout the state of California.
So we're getting two pictures here. On the one hand, Amanda's describing raids, particularly on people of color who are running illegal shops who end up with charges.
Not even people who are running the shops, the low-level employees who might not even know that the shop is illegal.
But the other side of that coin is there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of illegal shops that continue. So these raids must not be either effective or in other words, what's happening, Kat? Is it that there are a lot of raids, that there's enforcement happening, or is it that enforcement isn't happening and there are a lot of illegal shops, or maybe both are true?
Sure, and I appreciate the comment that Amanda is making, because one of the conversations that we've had here in the city of Los Angeles is around the historical enforcement that low-income and minority communities experience by way of past cannabis criminalization and the war on drugs. And the city council has had a conversation, even over the course of the last several months, of really trying to reassess what the city's enforcement strategy is and it is going to be. Historically, it's been one of whack-a-mole, where, you know, law enforcement may go out and shut a facility down, and they open and operate a few days later. And so what I think is necessary is for all stakeholders involved to reassess what the city's enforcement strategy is. I think that we're going to see the city shift into more administrative and civil penalties as opposed to criminal penalties against employees, for example. But the truth of the matter is that in order for our regulatory system to work, in order for businesses who are following the rules to feel comfortable and validated in what we're doing here, we do need to see a decrease in unlicensed activity in the city. And so we're constantly trying to reevaluate what those processes look like, but it's going to take time for us to get there.
Let's bring in another voice. Sunshine Lencho is an attorney specializing in the cannabis industry, co-founder of Supernova Women, an organization supporting women of color in the cannabis industry. Also a former member of the City of Oakland Cannabis Regulatory Commission. Thank you for coming in today. Kind of help us clear up the picture where you're dealing with a lot of businesses. That's your end of it. Clear up this picture of, you know, there are obviously a lot of illegal shops out there,
yeah,
and yet there's some enforcement. What's going on?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me today. I think it helps to sort of set in place a framework for the listeners where they understand how we got to where we are. So in 1996, we passed Prop 215, which made marijuana enforcement a low priority and allowed for people to collectively cultivate and, under SB 420, transport, manufacture, and provide to those who needed compassionate care cannabis. In most cities, that allowed for some sort of gray market to exist. And as a state, when we passed MMRSA in 2015, which was the former Medical Regulatory and Safety Act, and again when we passed Prop 64, we were saying we're ready to regulate these businesses and also help guide those operators from the gray market to an above-board, licensed, tested marketplace. What's actually happened, in fact, is that we've had six different sets of regulations within the last year. So from November 2017 to now, operators have had 300 pages of regulations that change and shift from month to month. We've had three,
from the city of LA, or
no, from the state, from our three state licensed agencies, right? And so, trying to parse through the changes and understand how that impacts your business requires not just legal support, but tax support, and also understanding how that shifts your operations, as you have to comply with the dual licensing system of local licensed entities and also your state requirements. When you're talking about the consumer-facing marketplace, you're looking at a marketplace that is generally dependent upon these local regulatory schemes. So as Kat was observing, we have 165 retail operators in Los Angeles. Statewide, we have about 590 brick and mortar, so you can walk in that door and purchase lawful cannabis. And we have a little under 200 delivery services. When you're thinking about what we have in terms of liquor licensing in West Hollywood, we have about 200 bars in West Hollywood to the 8 dispensaries they're about to have, right? So in terms of trying to find a lawful operator, it's pretty difficult. And when you're looking at the entire supply chain, when you have the majority of cities in California with bans on their books, which means that they do not permit lawful commercial cannabis activity in their jurisdiction, you're creating a supply chain problem. And it impacts everybody that I work with, whether they're a distributor, whether they're a manufacturer, they're a cultivator, or they're trying to transition their business. If there's no license that they can obtain, if they're waiting for the city of Los Angeles to complete its second phase of licensing so that they can get into that third phase, which would allow for an increase in brick and mortars, an increase in the cultivation opportunities, they're just sitting on property or they're sitting on a business that might be sunset.
We should note that marijuana has played a huge role in the underground economy in terms of really providing jobs for, mm-hmm. Low-level, marijuana sales.
Yeah, and you're seeing, this is not, an unsubstantiated issue. When you go up north to the Emerald Triangle, where a lot of this cannabis cultivation originated, and most of which ends up exported out of state, frankly, you're seeing that the change in regulation has really impacted the ancillary businesses. So people who had been able to operate restaurant providers or even the hydroponic stores that would then annually have an influx of, sort of migrant workers to their area, they're seeing ghost towns. You've had counties like Calaveras County licensed and banned, then licensed and banned within a year and a half period. So there's really no steady footing that people can look to, whether they're looking to enter the business or they've been in the business for 5, 10, or even 2 years. And when we have regulations change, and like I said, 6 different regulations in 1 year, it's hard to give good legal guidance to people. It's hard to predict things. And there's a lot of misinformation out there.
And the consequences are real. It's potential criminal prosecution. We are talking about the legalization of marijuana in Los Angeles and the state. There's more to this conversation after this short break. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Frank Stoltz, and we'll be right back. This is Air Talk. I'm Frank Stoltz, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Today we are looking at the legalization of marijuana in California 1 year later, state of the industry, state of enforcement, and many other issues. You're welcome to join us in this conversation if you have questions. We have lots of experts. 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. Jared Kylo is president of the United Cannabis Business Association, an L.A.-based cannabis industry group representing regulated cannabis retailers in California, and owner of the Higher Path Collective, a medical and recreational cannabis dispensary in Sherman Oaks. Jared, thank you for joining us. You've been reporting on the pot industry and very much engaged in the pot industry from the legal standpoint. What is your take on where the industry is at a year after legalization?
It's tough to really give it a scorecard when you see the foundation of this industry still waiting to be a part of the legal market. So that's the hardest part to really take in. The other good part, I think, is we're collecting tax dollars so that this industry can be regulated. And the people who are paying the taxes, I think, are taking the lion's share brunt of the hardships of the transition from this industry going from a gray market to a fully regulated one. And I think that's where some of the hardships come from. Amanda stated pretty clearly there were 1,700 dispensaries here. And if the taxpayers are only 10% of the market, and you're looking at 90% of the tax dollars being diverted out of the city of Los Angeles and out of the state coffers, you really see that as really the hitch pin for growth of the regulated market. Because if we had more people to go out and look at cultivation sites to make sure that they had a little bit more time to transition to the regulated market, you could have better consultants. You could have a transition period where cultivators could see a year or two of operation and know that in that first year or two that maybe they'll be able to get a license after a couple of years of transition. They've asked billions of dollars of infrastructure to transition into a regulated market way too quickly. I mean, you look at some markets that are just so large that they're given 25 years to transition from one part of a market to another. So I see that we need more time to transition, but there's this lost tax dollars. LA just had a bus that just came on, I think it was December 20th. They said they collected $20 million in illegal narcotics that were cannabis related. When you do the math on that, just that $20 million, if it made it to the sales of a retail market that's licensed and legal in the city of Los Angeles, meaning the 169 that are legal, that would have been $1.6 million in gross receipts tax for the city of Los Angeles to collect, and $200,000 in distribution taxes as well that could have been collected. I mean, that's $1.8 million in lost tax revenue that if we don't make sure we go after these gray market economy, then where do we get the tax dollars from? I mean, just in that $20 million, the state lost almost $4 million in tax revenue. I want to know, where are our incentives? And if our incentives are tax collection so that we can regulate our industry better, so that we can have quicker and easier transitions for the gray market to enter into the regulated market, then these tax dollars are really where it's at.
The gray or underground market is there for a reason, because the economy isn't providing enough jobs to people. And for in a lot of places, you know, that's how people made money to survive. And so these places are popping up for a reason. I guess it's you're essentially calling for more enforcement.
No, I'm saying like that gray market was already here. I mean, we've had 20 years of Prop 215, which created this whole infrastructure that everyone built. I mean, a cultivation site isn't just plants in the ground. Mm-hmm. It's water systems and recapturing. And there's so much work that goes into that and capital. So you're not taking the gray markets like infrastructure and transitioning into the regulated market. You're asking them to destroy that infrastructure, which is bad for labor, it's bad for tax collection, and it's bad for an industry that built for these regulations. Now the regulations are kind of turning their back on the ability to transition from what 20 years the state of California said was fine. And then 1 year and six regulations in 1 year later, a lot of these people are left out. And it is true.
Yeah. And Sunshine's point that there are so many more liquor licenses all over the place is well taken compared to marijuana licenses, business licenses. Let's take a call. Christopher in Ojai just called in with this question. How do I, as a consumer, know if a shop is legal or not? Jared, do you have the answer to that? Is there a sort of a seal of approval or seal of good housekeeping?
No, this is where I'm going to have to say the government's failed. All the other places, they're doing their best with the resources they have. But the fact that no one knows the difference between a legal and non-legal one, unless they go onto their government website and then scroll down to maps, and then they look at where the illegal shops are, those three or four steps is not a public service announcement. These are billboards that try to say, support your local community by paying tax dollars with the places that will pay them and support our infrastructure. That's where I think we're missing. It isn't easy to tell. Even when we've tried to give consistent seals through everyone, it's like everyone is just getting legal. I mean, so it's hard to tell on the face of it. You know, you have those normal regulations, which you can only be open till 10 p.m. in the city of Los Angeles. So if you're open at 10:30, you're not legal. And you're probably not legal in any way, shape, or form, not just in the time parameter side of things. And that's what we have to look at. Can we inform the consumer? You know, the reason why this whole pot bust happened in the city of Los Angeles, it stated very clearly that it's because it was from public tips. If $20 million in retail products were seized because of public tips, don't you think public service announcements would be really important? Look at the return on investment that would have been if we would have had more billboards. That's $1.8 million in tax revenue for the city of Los Angeles.
You might have a hard time doing a one-to-one analysis of that. Stick around. We'll come back to you. Kat Packer of the city's cannabis department responded to that, that as a consumer, there's no way to know if a shop is legal or not legal or what it is.
So I actually agree. I think that the government needs to, the city of Los Angeles has to step up its public information campaign and share that information. But in the interim, we do have the information available on our website, and all businesses in the city of Los Angeles are required to prominently display both their city license and their state license. We are trying to work on an emblem program. We know that the State Bureau of Cannabis Control is working on a public information campaign as well. But in the interim, consumers need to have that information, and so we're working to get them that information.
Just out of curiosity, why not have as many liquor licenses, as many marijuana licenses as liquor licenses?
Well, to respond to that directly, I don't know that we want to have as many marijuana licenses as there are liquor licenses. Here in the city of Los Angeles, there is a real and historic concern about over-concentration, undue concentration, particularly in low-income and minority communities. And so that's a conversation that our elected officials are constantly involved in. But I don't think that I'm not one of those people who like to do the comparison between marijuana and alcohol. I think that these are two very different substances.
Hmm. Let's take a call. We have on the line, I'm looking for the name. I can't see the name. Richard is on the line with a question. Richard, thanks for joining us on KPCC.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Yes, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay, ask your question.
Well, my question is, I own a licensed testing lab in Van Nuys, mm-hmm. Licensed by the city and the state. And we're wondering when the metric system will be up, because we're testing products for dispensaries or for the grows that are testing out at 300 times the legal limit for Category 1 pesticides. And there's no way for the city or the state to track that, to have them destroy that product. And they're just selling out on the black market or to illegal dispensaries.
Boy, that's a big question. And when you say 300 times, that is a state guideline for carcinogenic chemicals in food products?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's dragging their feet on getting this software system up. So what will happen is, once it's in the computer and it's tracked that it failed for pesticides, the state will have a record of it, and they'll have them destroy that crop.
Okay, so the crop comes from Northern California. Somebody tests that or wherever it comes from, down the street, somebody tests that. Does every product that enters a medical marijuana facility, let's call it just legal now, since the illegals do whatever they want to do, have to be tested? I don't know if you can answer that, Richard. Probably not. But let me ask Kat Packer, because you run the cannabis department.
So yes, every product that enters into a retail facility is required to be tested. The track and trace system that was referenced before, I was actually on a panel a couple of weeks ago with the individual who runs the Department of Food and Ag, the section that's responsible for the track and trace system. And as I've heard, the track and trace system has been up and running since the beginning of the year. It's being waited to be implemented for annual licensing. So what I would ask Richard to do is to contact the Department of Food and Agriculture, who's responsible for implementing the track and trace program. I know that they've received a lot of questions about its implementation. I think that there's been a lot of skepticism and concern, but I would relay that question specifically to that state agency.
We're talking about the legalization of marijuana in Los Angeles and California. We'll return to this conversation on the legalization of marijuana after this news break with Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Frank Stoltz, sitting in for Larry Mantle. And we're talking about the state of pot legalization. As we've heard from our guests, licensing for legal storefronts has run into some issues. And one of the issues that was just raised was the quality of marijuana, toxicity, the testing of marijuana. And there are concerns that if a crop or a part of a crop has too many chemicals in it, dangerous, that they're not allowed to go to the legal pot shops in the state or in Los Angeles, but instead are diverted to the illegal market, sort of defeating the purpose of getting this type of marijuana plant or product off the market. I don't know if there's a solution to that. I feel like I want to ask you, Sunshine, what happens? What should happen?
Well, in the scenario that Richard discussed, the state has received the failed test results. So for every product that enters the marketplace that has been tested at a licensed lab, the state is emailed a copy of those results. The state issues weekly reports, that's the Bureau of Cannabis Control, about how many batches failed, what they failed for. And once I believe the regulator is tipped off to such a significant discrepancy between what will pass and what won't, I think that flags that particular licensee. So while it is possible that they are diverting that to the illicit market, I think that it's only so much longer that they'll be able to do so because there have been visits by regulators that they have shown up unannounced at licensed premises. And you run the risk as a commercial licensed cannabis business of losing your licensing entirely if you haven't followed the proper protocols. There are, in our regulations, rules about where you're supposed to dispose of failed products. Those products, when they're out for testing, are being held in quarantine. It is very similar to sort of like good manufacturing practices that you will see once we actually have federal regulation, right? So you quarantine it. The testing lab comes in. They cannot be an interested party. They can't be owned by a manufacturer or cultivator. Once it's failed, the state knows it's failed. You may process that product into additional products that may or may not pass. So there is a possibility that that failed batch will be recreated into something new. But for those people who are using the illicit market as a solution, they'll probably face criminal penalties for doing so. It's a huge public health issue. And I think the most important thing, I think, as a state has been to minimize the risk to the public while maximizing the business opportunity for licensees.
I don't think we have good numbers on enforcement and prosecution in the first year. I haven't seen any. Has anybody seen any? I'd like to turn now, as we look at this issue of pot legalization in California 1 year later, to another facet of the topic, and that is public safety, particularly cracking down on driving while on pot. I want to bring in Sergeant Oscar Chavez, a supervisor with the impaired driving section at the California Highway Patrol headquarters in Sacramento. Thanks for joining us, Sergeant.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Where are we at in terms of identifying drivers who may be under the influence and then proving it?
Well, currently, we do have to train our officers on impaired driving. Currently, the California Highway Patrol is a state coordinator when it comes to implementing the IACP, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, Drug Evaluation Classification Program. So we facilitate that program for the entire state. Not only do we train CHP officers, we train our partners, our allied agencies, in impaired driving. And it comes in different phases. The first phase would be the standardized field sobriety test class, which is a basic understanding of impaired driving. The student officer,
as it relates specifically to marijuana,
not quite yet, not at that point. No. We're covering pretty much impaired driving overall. We're not just looking at alcohol or driving under the influence of alcohol, but also other drugs, including cannabis.
And as I understand it, essentially you're using the standard field sobriety test. Somebody's weaving or whatever, you pull them over, do a standard field sobriety test, and if they fail it, you've got the. For alcohol, you have the blood alcohol test, you have the breathalyzer, but you don't have something similar for marijuana, right?
That's correct. The officer will gather all his evidence, how the person was driving, was he weaving, speeding, whatever the situation was, and then we'll go into the second part once they make contact with the driver and gather further evidence. What do they see? What do they smell? What are they hearing? And then, as you explained, the standardized field sobriety test or the field sobriety test, that would be the final phase before determining whether the influence of alcohol, whether they're impaired or not, or drugs as well. The officer will make that determination. If they do believe, like you did mention, you know, we do have the breath test, you know, to determine under the influence of alcohol. When it comes to driving the influence of drugs, including cannabis, there is a further step that's called the DRE process, the drug recognition evaluation process, where as soon as the officer makes the field arrest, they would call upon an officer who has further training in evaluating someone under the influence of alcohol, and they would go through a 12-step process when determining whether they're safe to drive or not at the time. And the conclusion of that, then we would, the only test that we have in order to determine if they're under the influence or if there's anything in their system would be a blood test at that point. Currently, we don't have a breath test for a cannabis. At that point, it would relate to rely to blood.
So, of course, you do a blood test, but there's no threshold. You haven't determined at what point someone is legally impaired, like the 0.08 for alcohol.
That's correct. Cannabis is very different compared to alcohol. It affects everyone differently. There's different strains when it comes to cannabis. You had like sativa and indica that affect the body differently. So we can't put a number. For example, 5 nanograms is thrown out a lot lately. We can't put a number because that does not correlate to what you see the person of the influence of. It might be different. So currently we do not have a per se level. So we just have to go based on observation, take the totality of the evidence, what the officer sees, what the DRE sees, and then continue from there on.
Did I hear you say that if an officer pulls somebody over, suspects, you know, no signs of alcohol, but suspects marijuana, that he has to call another officer to the scene to conduct a 12-step process?
Not necessarily call another officer. The officer might be trained as well. What happens is the officer at that point determines at that point, does he, based on his observation, does he believe he's under the influence and is he safe to drive? If he believes that he's not safe to drive, then that field officer will place that person under arrest for driving under the influence. At that point, that officer will request a drug evaluation expert to conduct a further evaluation of the driver at a separate location, at a secure location.
Okay. So, and that's CHP.
That's correct. That's us and as well as Ally California. We do train Ally agencies as well. We are the state coordinator when it comes to the impaired driving classification program, the drug evaluation classification program. So we do train Ally agencies as well in this process.
So what's the upshot? Are we seeing an increase in the number of people driving under the influence of marijuana to the extent that it impairs their driving and endangers people?
It's really hard to nail down stats just the way the law's written. We do have the 23152 of the VICA code, which is what we charge when it comes to driving the influence. However, when we talk about driving the influence of drugs and alcohol, for example, one of the statutes states driving the influence of drugs, and the other one is driving the influence of alcohol and drugs. Unfortunately, when we come to the opinion that the person was under the influence of cannabis, it just gets lumped into that one drug category.
No good stats.
We currently don't have any. However, we are working, putting some things in place in order to start gathering stats to provide numbers.
Well, if the CHP doesn't have the numbers, I imagine most police departments around the state don't have numbers either.
I can't answer for them, but probably.
Okay. Anecdotally, is there a sense that the legalization of marijuana has endangered people on the roadways?
I mean, we could look to other states that have already have legalized recreational marijuana, and we have seen upticks when it comes to driving under the influence. I mean, we do ask the public if they are going to be consuming a cannabis, whether edible or smoking it, and just to make sure that they don't get behind the wheel, that they actually, you know, there's other options out there to get from point A to point B. You got rideshare service as well as mass transit.
Well, it sounds a little bit like the Wild West still in enforcement as well as in terms of the legal operations and illegal operations at the retail level. Sergeant Oscar Chavez, talking about how the California Highway Patrol has been dealing with people who drive while high on pot. We'll return to this conversation on the legalization of marijuana after this news break with Hedy Lynn Hurtis. This is Air Talk. I'm Frank Stoltz, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Larry's on vacation this week. We are talking about the legalization of marijuana in California 1 year later. And you're hearing that it's been a bit of a messy process, both in terms of the enforcement of laws and the licensing of retail outlets. I'd like to just go a little bit further in terms of enforcement. Have you seen any increase in, or I guess because you're not filing specifically on DUIs for marijuana, there's just no notation in prosecutor's files? No, you know, I mean, at some point, doesn't there have to be smelled marijuana, the word marijuana in an arrest or a filing?
Yes, if they're going to be obviously filing with whatever DA they're going to file the case, there is going to be a
narrative.
This person is going to be under the influence of said drug, in this case maybe cannabis, or it could be a stimulant, whatever the situation is. So in the narrative, it would come down to the conclusion whether it's on the narrative of the DRE officer or even of the arresting officer.
Okay.
It would indicate a specific category.
So no uptick in California on the roadways. There are some anecdotes from other states, but there's no definitive numbers in California.
As far as we know right now, since we were unable to gather, or we don't have the ability to gather stats and compare stats to prior years, just based on how the statute is written, we don't have any definitive stats.
Amanda, you wanted to mention something in terms of enforcement of these laws and how they're playing out on the streets.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of concern about cannabis DUIs, right? And if you're a tourist and you're not used to cannabis or if you feel yourself impaired from cannabis, you obviously shouldn't drive. But if you're looking at this year versus last year, the effects of legalization, consumption has not changed dramatically. People are essentially consuming the same amount of cannabis they were before.
What do you base those numbers on?
That's generally consistent across the board when you look at legalization in other places. And if you look at California in particular, we don't have good numbers on almost anything since so much of it is in the illicit market. But if you look at California, access to cannabis has not substantially changed because of legalization. It's not like before legalization, nobody had access to cannabis. All you needed to do was go into any of these storefront doctor's offices, give them $30, they'd give you a recommendation, and then you go buy cannabis. Like, it was not a difficult process.
So me walking down the street, just follow up real quickly,
sure.
Me walking down the street and smelling marijuana more often, just generally, right? I don't know if anyone else is having this experience. Maybe it's just my neighborhood. It is more a phenomenon of people feeling more comfortable going out and smoking than actual more people smoking.
And that might be confirmation bias also. But I think the more important thing when it comes to cannabis DUIs is that, you know, we have no effective technology to measure whether someone is impaired from cannabis. I smoked cannabis last night. I would test, you know, as legally impaired right now in Colorado, even though I am not impaired at all. If you think about it, we're probably going to have the technology for self-driving cars before we're going to have the technology to measure whether someone's impaired from cannabis. And in the context of things, when you look at things like in October, CNN made a huge deal out of rising accidents in Colorado, Washington, and Oregon. Then when you looked at that study, you know, from the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, you saw that in the study, it says there was no statistically significant increase in Washington and Oregon. Then when you compare cannabis to alcohol, right? Alcohol is responsible for 28% of all traffic-related fatalities every year. That's over 10,000 deaths a year. We're not seeing that same thing with cannabis. We're not going to see that same thing with cannabis. And when...
Why are we not going to see the same thing with cannabis?
Because it doesn't impair people
in the same way.
Nearly as much. And studies have shown cannabis is 114 times more safe than alcohol.
This makes you hungry. One of the things that confuses me is, why hasn't big industry come in? In other words, there's a prediction that once legalization happened in California, you'd have these giant, you know, agribusinesses, multinationals come in and sort of take over the production of them, the distribution of them. Sunshine, why hasn't that happened, or is it happening behind the scenes?
So I'm pretty agnostic as to business type, except to the extent that I think that the people who are most prosecuted should be the first to get their licenses. But in terms of who we see on the ground, I would say big business has been looking at this since before 2017, before we even had Prop 64 as a concept. We've tried to legalize before with Prop 19. So they've been eyeing it. I think that there are also ways in which you can structure your businesses where you may find that there's a lot of big business that's behind some of these companies. Some consolidation is happening. But the reality is that when you have over 65% of the jurisdictions with bans, there's not enough of a market opportunity for people to really operate without having their businesses operate at a loss. So when you're looking at the substantial hurdles to entering the market, first, you have to be in a place that has decent tax rates that also is permitting businesses. We just finished a license process here in LA, and that means there won't be additional retail opportunities until maybe next summer. Maybe Kat can give us some hints on that, because I know everybody's excited to hear when that might open up. And, you know, so you have this money, you're coming from Canada, but you can't just buy up an operation. There's rules about who can own businesses. Some jurisdictions require a residency. Some jurisdictions require certain types of identity. So when we're talking about social equity programs in Oakland, San Francisco, LA, Sacramento, they're identifying people who are from specific communities who have had certain types of convictions or have grown up in areas that have been significantly neglected in terms of economic development, and they are the first to get licenses. So it's become harder for big business to enter, and this isn't uncommon. Washington State required residency, so you know, to the extent that we are, you know, trying to encourage small business in California or the transition of our illicit market into the regulated market, it's going to be more challenging. But they're here.
Yeah, I would also just add that there are, you know, you earlier said something about cannabis farmers in Northern California. The truth is now most of the legal cannabis farmers are in Central California or further south in Santa Barbara or San Luis Obispo, where you have mega farms that are growing far more cannabis than the state had initially intended for individual businesses to be able to grow before 2023. And then when you look about, you know, existing large corporations that are getting into cannabis, that's happening in Canada, not in California, because of the federal illegality around cannabis makes it so that you can't use the banking system, you can't take tax deductions if you're running a cannabis business in California. But if you're Altria, right, which is a major tobacco company that put billions of dollars into a Canadian cannabis company, or if you're Constellation Brands, which is a major alcohol company that put billions of dollars into a Canadian cannabis company, you're looking at Canada where it's federally legal and it's easier to do.
Kat Packer of the L.A. City Cannabis Department. Do we just have 30-40 seconds here? What is the next big decision out of your department? We're hearing that you may be placing a number on how many more licenses you're going to issue.
Sure. So the city of Los Angeles right now is focusing on continuing to issue temporary approval to our existing medical market and also bringing the supply chain through that we begin to receive applications for our existing supply chain market. As we head into next year, we're really going to start to focus very heavily on our social equity program. As mentioned previously, the city of Los Angeles has a social equity program which is intended to acknowledge and address some of the harms that communities and had experienced by way of the war on drugs. We're going to be sharing information about our social equity program on our website, going through various processes where we can verify that folks qualify under the social equity program. We know that there are now new resources at the state that may be available for our local social equity program. And so we're going to be working through the kinks of not only that, but just continuing to move forward with our annual licensing process, which our 169 businesses who already have temporary approval will be going through. There are going to be a number of policy
The growing pains continue, clearly, for the legalization of pot in the city of Los Angeles and throughout California. I'm Frank Stoltz, sitting in for Larry Mantle today. Thanks for joining us.